Got a good one for you right here. We are joined by a longtime golf writer, a contributor to Golf Digest, recipient of 11 first place awards from the Golf Writers Association of America, I should say. Partner at the Fire Pit Collective. He is the author of 6 books. He is Alan Shipnook. Alan, what's going on? Good to have you back. How are you?
I'm happy to be back, Rumi. Thanks for having me.
So good to have you. I was looking forward to it. Listen, you've got a great, great piece up for Golf Digest on John Rahm's win yesterday. What was going through your head? Let me start right here, Alan. What was going through your head when you watched one big player after another implode on the back nine the way they did?
Well, of course, I was enjoying it because that is the essence of the United States Open. You need carnage. It's designed to be a war of attrition. I mean, the way they set up the golf course, it's supposed to push the players to the breaking point physically, mentally, you know, metaphysically. It's just, that's what this tournament's all about. And so it was delicious. But you hope in the end someone will do something dramatic to make it memorable. You don't want the champion to limp home. And so when Ron made that putt on 17, you could kind of feel the moment building. And of course instantly famous putt on 18 to essentially win the win the U.S. Open was the moment we needed. I mean, 13 years after Tiger holed a similar putt to the same pin position on the same green, it was really an incredible exclamation point on a very memorable final round.
No doubt. Alan Shipnook joining us. So why don't we talk about each of those two putts? What about when he got to 17, that 25-footer for birdie? What did you make of that putt?
What was interesting is, well, as you mentioned, all the players who were blowing up out there. Obviously, Bryson DeChambeau was the most spectacular self-immolation, but Rory McIlroy, Colin Morikawa, I mean, Brooks Koepka, these are big-time players, and they were just getting their teeth kicked in by Torrey Pines. And during all that, Rahm was just making, you know, these gritty U.S. Open pars, which is what you have to do, and he just hung in there. And it was impressive the patience he displayed, because you could tell he was getting a little edgy. He wanted to make something happen. And, you know, that putt on 17 was not an easy one. I mean, it had about 3 feet of break and coming down the hill, but it was like he was finally rewarded. He hadn't pushed too hard like some of these other guys. And it was just a beautiful kind of feel putt. You just feed it down, and he just matched the speed and the line so perfectly. And he really deserved that. I mean, he played lights out golf the whole way, and he just waited. It's kind of like when you're on the freeway and you're just cruising, and all of a sudden you just step on the gas. That's what it felt like. So, I mean, that was a harder putt than the one in 18. Although, of course, the magnitude of the moment might change that calculus. But you know, when Rahm poured that in on 17, it was like, here we go. You could just feel something special coming.
Alan Shipnook is joining us. Alan, I thought you had an amazing line in the piece about 18. Quote, holding a putt like this has almost nothing to do with technical proficiency. It is an X-ray of the soul, a referendum on the unseen parts of a golfer that cannot be measured with a TrackMan, heart, guts, balls. End of quote. So that putt on 18, maybe not technically as tough as 17, but what's that putt tell you about this guy's heart, his guts, and, well, you know, his nad?
Well, he needs a wheelbarrow for after those bits.
Right.
I mean, that every player, you know, grows up saying that they want to putt to win the U.S. Open until that moment arrives, and then so many just shrink from it. And, you know, Rahm has been a top prospect for a long time. I mean, there's some great stories about when he was an undergrad at Arizona State, he was getting in Phil Mickelson's pocket regularly, and Phil was calling the guys at Callaway saying, you need to sign this dude. He's like one of the 10 best players in the world right now, and, you know, he's in science class. And so you could see this was coming. I mean, Rahm's been a consistent winner on the U.S. PGA Tour and in Europe. And he's had a lot of, you know, top tens of the majors. Like, he was due. We all knew this was going to happen. But this was really the first time he faced that defining moment. And to absolutely gut that putt like he did, it just instantly separates him from all these other kind of talented young players who just don't have that sort of karmic ability to make that putt. I mean, anyone on the PGA Tour can make an 18-footer at any time, but to do it with the U.S. Open hanging in the balance was very macho. And, you know, Tiger Woods established an impossible standard. Like, no one is ever going to close out tournaments and big tournaments the way that the Tiger did so, you know, ruthlessly. But I think Rahm can be a closer of the first, you know, magnitude, and golf really needs that. I mean, you know, even Brooks Koepka, who kind of built his brand on winning the big one, the last 2 years, he's let a bunch get away, including yesterday. I mean, three bogeys in the last six holes, and when he had a beautiful, you know, prime opportunity to win. And a lot of these guys just don't get it done. And for Rahm, you know, to kick down the door like that, it's really special, and it makes, you know, me and I think everyone else in the golf world quite excited to see where he goes from here.
See, I was going to go there next. Alan Shipnook joining us, because your piece for Golf Digest opens with this, quote, "Sometimes if we're lucky, the man and the moment collide on the 72nd hole, producing transcendence. Think Seve at St. Andrews or Tiger at Torrey or Phil at Augusta. Time will tell if John Rahm deserves to share the same sentence as those legends." End of quote. You're right, Alan. Time will tell. But if you had to guess or you had to bet, years from now, is he going to deserve to share the same sentence as those legends?
I mean, I think he has a chance to be in that pantheon. I mean, you look at Phil. All those players had a fatal flaw in some ways. You know, Phil couldn't drive the ball on the planet, and Seve got in his own head, and basically he was done in his mid-30s with swing changes and sort of paralysis. And Tiger, while his game was bulletproof, we know his life was a mess off the course. And Rahm seems to have it all figured out. I mean, from every aspect of his game is incredibly sound. I mean, he hits it a mile. He's extremely precise. He's got these magic hands. You know, he's sort of a descendant of Seve and Jose Mario Lothabo. You know, Paul Casey told me he's just got those Spanish hands. There's just something in the way he tips and pitches that is so beautiful. And he obviously can make the putts that matter. And he's, you know, he's married. He's got a kid. He's got this whole support staff around him. And, you know, Phil's become a great friend and mentor. And it just seems like he's got everything figured out at age 26. And I really think that he's just going to keep going. I mean, there's not a golf course setup that doesn't work for him. I mean, he can shape the ball. He can play all the crafty shots in the wind at the Open. He can bomb it at a PGA Championship and in Augusta. He can obviously survive a tough, narrow U.S. Open setup. So, you know, Nick Faldo has six major championships. He's sort of the gold standard for European golfers. I would not be surprised in the least if Rahm gets there. And then that's very rarefied air. I mean, there's only a dozen guys who have won more than that. So, you know, it's a long career. We've seen a lot of guys get sidetracked. You look at Rory McIlroy, who, you know, he's gone 7 years now without winning a big one, and in the prime of what should be the prime of his career. And so there's mystifying things that you know, kind of get these players off track. But Rahm is so focused. He's so single-minded, and he's so dedicated. I think he's just going to keep going, and it's going to be really fun to watch.
I do, too. I agree. Alan Shipnook, my guest. Alan, one last thought. You also have another great piece up for Golf Digest about Tiger's win at Torrey in 2008 and how that really was the end of the Tiger era, although we didn't know it at the time. You know, the game has changed. Times have changed. But, for instance, how much younger, taller, and more powerful are the players now compared to even just 2008?
Yeah, there's some interesting stats in that story that I learned in the research. I mean, it has become such a power game, and Tiger definitely attracted a different kind of athlete. And when you there's an interesting chart about the average height on tour players, and you see a huge spike that corresponds with, like, all these 8- and 10-year-olds who got into the game when Tiger was doing his thing, and then they reached the tour. You know, I think 40% now are 6'2 or taller. I mean, the stereotype of the little golf nerd who could not succeed in other sports, while still there's a grain of truth. I mean, there's some big boys who are now playing the sport, and they're swinging the club at speeds that the old-timers could not even comprehend. And so, unfortunately, you know, a lot of the playing field dates to the 19th century. I mean, every sport, the athletes are getting bigger and stronger, but they cancel each other out because they're playing defense. So you can have a 6'9" point guard that would make Bob Cousy, you know, look ridiculous, but now the dude who's guarding him is 6'7" and just as quick. And so it holds the sport in check, but in golf, the courses can't keep up. And so that's part of the tension in the game right now, is these modern athletes who are fully optimized in every way with statistics and launch monitors and cutting-edge training methods and diets and Swedish nannies and the whole bit. You know, they roll up to a course that was built 100-plus years ago, and it just can't contain them. But, you know, from an entertainment perspective, it's fun to watch these guys smash the ball, and I'm not sure if the casual fan worries about, you know, some of these classic courses being rendered obsolete, but for sure the game has changed rapidly. I mean, you know, John Rahm, like, his thighs look like they're, you know, on loan from a redwood forest. I mean, he's just, the amount of force he creates is incredible. And but you still have to hit the shot stuff and make the putts, and so that's always going to be the differentiator, even as the game moves more towards a power sport. And that's why Rahm in particular is exciting, because he has an old school feel and touch and knack for scoring that a guy like Bryson DeChambeau or some of these others just, that's eluded them. So I think he's the best of kind of the old and the new way.
Alan Shipnick, my guest, really quickly, what about DeChambeau? Like, there were a lot of world-class players that completely imploded, but none that came in with 44. Like, what did you think watching what happened to him, and exactly what did happen to him other than Torrey?
Yeah, it was, I mean, he almost jarred his tee shot. He was 1 inch from what would have been an iconic ace on the eighth hole. And even so, that put him in the lead, and he looked so in control. And, you know, Bryson is, he's a head case, right? And it works for him in that he's on this never-ending quest to improve and to try and outsmart the game of golf. And he's made some headway, and he's made some progress, and he's found some side doors, but ultimately there are a lot of demons upstairs with him, and he just hit a couple shots and he completely went mental. And when you're swinging the club at the speed that he is, when you start holding on a little tight and you start trying to steer it, bad things happen. And he just lost all the freedom with which he'd been playing with, and he had no idea where the golf ball was going. It was incredible to watch. I mean, guys get overpowered by a U.S. Open setup with some regularity, but not when they're at the very top of the leaderboard with nine holes to play. That was a historic collapse. The shoot 44 when you're leading the tournament at the turn is just utterly mind-boggling. I mean, it's beyond John Vandeveld. You know, he played great for 71 holes. Like, Bryson completely lost the plot, and honestly, it was delicious. And it's fun to watch the torture be visited upon this guy, because he brings so much of it upon himself. And I like Bryson. I like writing about him. I think he's a breath of fresh air. But at the same time, it's kind of more fun when he's struggling, because it just sends him down more rabbit holes, and who knows what's next. But yeah, you can't overstate. That would be like basically an NBA player who's got 52 points through three quarters. He went like 0-for-19 in the fourth quarter, right, and got blown out. Like, it's in Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Like, it's just hard to even come up with parallels for how bad that performance was. But it was certainly riveting to watch.
Nothing like it. He is a longtime golf writer. He's a contributor to Golf Digest, a recipient, as I mentioned, of 11 first-place awards from the Golf Writers Association of America, a partner at the Fire Pit Collective, and the author of 6 different books. My man, nobody better, Alan Shipnook, my guest. Alan, great to have you back. Thank you so much. That was a blast.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Alan Shipnook, man, we put guys on to talk about that sport, and there are a number that are very, very, very good. My man Rex Hoggard, right near the top of the list. Robert Lucetich is awesome. But you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody better than Alan Shipnook. Those three are in their own class.